under advisement. Our fifth case for argument this morning is Grigsby against Cotton. Mr. Dayes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Greg Dayes. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Anthony Grigsby. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The heart of this appeal lies one simple question: whether the district court erred in concluding that Grigsby could not proceed with his Sixth Amendment claim despite the Supreme Court's decision in Lackawanna v. Koss. The answer to that question is plainly yes. Under the general rule, once a state conviction is no longer open to direct or collateral attack in its own right, a criminal defendant may not use a 2254 petition to challenge a subsequent sentence enhancement based on that conviction on the grounds that the prior conviction was unconstitutionally obtained. In Koss, however, the Supreme Court recognized an exception to this general rule, where the habeas petition challenges an enhanced sentence on the basis that the prior conviction used to enhance the sentence was obtained in violation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Here, Mr. Grigsby claims that in 1978, an Indiana juvenile court waived jurisdiction over two criminal counts without affording him the benefit of counsel in violation of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. 10 years later, in 1988, that unconstitutional conviction was used to enhance his sentence for attempted robbery. Plainly, Grigsby's claim falls within the exception recognized in Koss. The district court's conclusion to the contrary was an error. The state does not respond to Grigsby's allegations directly. In fact, on page 7 of its response brief, the government concedes that Grigsby's claim would, quote, perhaps be successful if Indiana law were different, close quote. According to the state, however, the Indiana juvenile court's determination that it had exclusive jurisdiction over the two counts, thus requiring waiver to criminal court, was erroneous under Indiana law existing at the time. But this contention does not help the state's cause for at least two reasons. First, all indications in the record are that a waiver determination did in fact occur at an initial hearing.
A waiver what?
A waiver determination, Your
determination.
Honor.
Now, can the court just unilaterally waive it into adult court under those circumstances when there's a charge of murder?
Well, the murder count, exclusive jurisdiction for the murder count would have lied with the criminal court, but for the other two counts, exclusive jurisdiction remained with the juvenile court, and there was a hearing required under Indiana state law at the time. And the hearing would look
so
at...
if it were not, if murder weren't part of it?
No, that's under Indiana state law, Your Honor. Murder and any lesser included offenses would necessarily fall within the exclusive jurisdiction of the criminal court. But if the other offenses, the other charges, are not lesser included offenses, they would still remain within the exclusive jurisdiction of the juvenile court, and a waiver hearing would be required.
So he would be automatically waived into adult court for the murder charge, which was later dropped, I guess, or whatever. And the, was armed robbery?
Yes, armed robbery and then conspiracy to commit armed robbery. And I'd cite this court to Simpson v. State, 381 Northeast 2nd, 1229. That court, there the Indiana Supreme Court draws out the distinction. There's two other cases that help flesh out the state of Indiana law at the time. Those other two cases are Blythe v. State, 373 Northeast 2nd, 1098.
Are they in your brief?
They are not, Your Honor. The only case cited in the brief is the case cited by the state, which is Lindley. But with all respect to the state, that case doesn't answer the question. All that does is stand for the unremarkable proposition that the charge, rather than the subsequent finding of guilt or innocence, dictates the question of whether exclusive jurisdiction resides in the juvenile court or the criminal court. But to that question as well, the fact that all indications in the record are that a waiver hearing did in fact occur, and I'd also note that the state, in its brief before the Indiana Appellate Court, expressly argued that a hearing had occurred. But because all indications in the record are that a hearing did in fact occur, it's apparent that the Indiana state courts construed Indiana state law to require a waiver. And despite...
Counsel, I'm interested in the question whether any of this has been preserved for decision on federal collateral attack. And there is a pretty obvious timeliness problem. Not your fault, since you got into this rather long after it, but the conviction became final in 1990, which is rather more than a year ago. And there is a rather obvious exhaustion and procedural default issue, since I take it that it's established that this was never, this argument was never presented to the Supreme Court of Indiana.
Well, with all respect, the court needs to pay close attention to the particulars of the state's procedural default argument. What the state is arguing is not that the claim, Mr. Grigsby's Sixth Amendment claim, was never presented to the Indiana courts. What they're arguing is that he procedurally defaulted by failing to take that, by failing to raise the merits argument before the Indiana Supreme Court.
I'm being quite precise.
Okay. No, I
failed to present it to the Supreme Court of Indiana, and under O'Sullivan against Borkel, that is a procedural default, which precludes its consideration on federal collateral review.
Well, the Indiana Court of Appeals, Judge Eastbrook, had not considered
I that. Understand that, but O'Sullivan against Borkel, for good or ill, is binding on this court. There has been a default under authoritative law. And what's left?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that that rule applies where the appellate court, the intermediate court, had not passed on the question.
It certainly applies. This is not an open question.
Okay. Well, in the event it's not an open question, two points. One would be that under Wainwright, we can still proceed with the claim in light of if there's cause and prejudice. But the other point would be that the state waived this argument or forfeited this argument.
Well, forfeited. It did not waive it, right? And then we have the question whether under Granberry against Greer we should reach it. Now, your brief doesn't discuss Granberry against Greer. The Supreme Court has held that failure to raise an exhaustion or default defense is not a waiver, and that courts may and often should raise this defense on their own.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think the district court would be in the best position to determine whether there was a forfeiture.
No, the holding of Granberry is that an appellate court may raise it on its own. You may not be familiar with that case, but this is an issue that the Supreme, you know, we're just dealing with Supreme Court authority here.
I understand, Your Honor, but and there's a distinction between waiver and forfeiture, as this court recognized in Paraquet, and the question of whether this defense was forfeited by the state's failure to raise it in its initial response is a question better put to the district court.
So you want us to disregard Granberry, which says that a court of appeals may take cognizance even if it hasn't been put to the district court?
Well, I think that in determining whether the court ought to consider a defense that the state otherwise forfeited, Paraquet gives this court some guidance as to factors that ought to be considered. Here, I would respectfully submit that the procedural default is not as clear as it was in Paraquet. You're right, Your Honor. I can't speak to the Granberry decision. But in Paraquet, which is where the Seventh Circuit recognized a similar proposition that it can.
We're an inferior court. We don't. It is not within our power to recognize or not recognize decisions of the Supreme Court. We only follow them. Right. So there are cases where we have used the authority provided by the Supreme Court. But it's not that we can choose to follow or not follow or recognize or not recognize as if this were a foreign judgment.
No, I understand, Your Honor, but I don't think that the Seventh Circuit is required to consider that defense. And if I might speak to why the court should not, I would point the court to the factors laid out in Paraquet, where the court decided that it could consider a defense that was not raised below by the state. I think the case is similar. And so the Paraquet decision shows how this court previously has looked at the question of whether it ought to consider a defense that the state otherwise would have forfeited by failure to raise below. One of those questions is whether the procedural default was clear. And again, I think here it's not quite as clear because you had the Indiana Appellate Court not considering the question, and thus taking the Latches question up to the Indiana Supreme Court could have resulted in, if the Latches determination was overruled, then the Indiana Appellate Court would have been forced to consider the merits question. But it didn't consider the merits question. In light of that, I think Mr. Grigsby's failure to take it up to the Indiana Supreme Court, even if it falls within the strict letter of the Supreme Court's decision, ought to weigh in favor of not considering this claim in light of the state's forfeiture. In addition, we're dealing with the Sixth Amendment violation here, one of the core constitutional principles. That also militates in favor of considering this question. The state did have a chance to consider it, so this isn't a case like Paraquet where there was never a chance for the state court to rule on the Sixth Amendment claim. The state courts of Indiana did have a chance to do so, and so the comity and federalism principles, even if at stake here, are not as much so as in other cases where the state courts were not given a chance at all to consider the question. I won't reserve anything. Mm-hmm. Do you have a question, Judge Easterbrook?
Yes,
sorry.
Yes, thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Covey.
May it please the court, as petitioner has failed to present a cognizable claim, this court should affirm the district court's denial of his request for a writ of habeas corpus. Under Indiana law, at the time of Mr. Grigsby's 1978 conviction, the circuit court had exclusive and original jurisdiction of his criminal case. The juvenile court had no jurisdiction to hear any part of Grigsby's case.
He tries to divide it, though, between the murder and for the armed robbery and conspiracy.
Correct, and I'm not aware of the opinion of Simpson that he cites, but it's clear that in Blythe that that may become an issue after the charges go forward. If a juvenile defendant who is automatically in adult court attempts to plead guilty to a lesser offense that's not a lesser included offense, the Indiana Supreme Court said in that situation, in order for that juvenile to plead guilty to an offense that wasn't charged, he would have to go back to juvenile court. But it's clear under the law at the time that the jurisdiction was in adult circuit court for the crime.
60 days to get an attorney appointed, do I call that correctly?
Excuse me?
Did it take 60 days before he had a counsel appointed?
It's unclear from the record when, I think that's when counsel appeared in the case. It's unclear when counsel originally met with Grigsby. But it's clear that during that whole adult proceeding, he had counsel for every critical stage during that proceeding up to pleading guilty.
So a question, I guess, at some point, I guess, when they, I don't know, somehow got the murder out of it, really do plead to...
He pled guilty to armed robbery,
so
which
was
charged, which was in the original charge.
So he just got away from the murder part.
Correct.
So he was still in adult court and got 10 years.
Correct. And any argument he had that was an improper result obviously doesn't affect the costs exception, because at that point he had counsel, and if there was a problem and somehow...
He was represented
at that point, so counsel could have argued that was improper, but he didn't. I would point out, petitioner points out that the state has not taken a clear position on this. I would point out that petitioner, up to his brief before this court, contended that no hearing occurred. Not that a hearing occurred and he didn't have counsel. He contended that no hearing occurred, and the state's position has always been that no matter if a hearing occurred or not, there is no procedural anomaly here because the circuit court had jurisdiction from the beginning. But even if this court were to find this to meet the exception of costs, the claim is procedurally defaulted and the petition is time barred. The claim is procedurally defaulted in two ways. First, for the failure to present it to the Indiana Supreme Court under O'Sullivan v. Borkel, but also under the adequate and independent state law ground of latches that the Indiana Court of Appeals and the post-conviction court before it rested its decision on. So in both those ways, this claim is procedurally defaulted. The state has not procedurally defaulted its procedural default argument and its time bar argument if you look at how this case progressed through the district court. In April of 2004, petitioner filed his petition challenging his 1978 conviction, raising two claims. One, that he was not given his Boykin rights at his guilty plea hearing, and number two, that the Indiana Court of Appeals erroneously relied on latches. In response to this petition, the state filed its answer claiming that he does not meet the custody requirement because he's no longer in custody for the 1978 conviction, and that even if he were to meet the custody requirement by claiming that he's attacking his 1988 conviction first and then to reach his 1978 conviction, he doesn't present a cognizable claim. In response to that, the petitioner filed a traverse claiming the exception in costs. And after that, the district court then requested the petitioner make clear whether he was challenging his 1978 conviction or 1988 conviction. In response to that, petitioner filed a supplemental traverse making clear that he was challenging the 1988 conviction so he could meet the custody requirement and repeating his costs exception argument. The district court again entered another entry asking the petitioner to state how his denial of the right to counsel claim was preserved, and petitioner didn't respond to that argument. So the state's first opportunity to respond to his claim that he meets the cost exception and that his 1988 petition, his petition challenging his 1988 conviction is time barred, was the brief before this court. So the state doesn't believe it has procedurally defaulted either its procedural default claim or its time bar claim, and both those claims are clear here. This petition is time barred and the claim is procedurally defaulted. No other questions.
Is there any reason why neither side in this case has discussed either Granberry against Greer or 28 U.S.C. 2254b3, which are the two things that actually bear on the resolution of this question?
Because the state doesn't believe that it has waived the procedural default or time bar argument. And I realize that this court...
What you're saying is you don't think you've waived something, therefore you don't need to discuss the applicable legal principles that determine whether you've waived something.
Well, I'm not sure I follow your...
Look, if you want to make an argument that a court should disregard a forfeiture, you would think that you would cite and discuss a statute bearing on this question and the controlling decision of the Supreme Court.
The state's position, though, is that it has not forfeited these arguments.
Whether the state has forfeited these arguments depends on how one understands Granberry against Greer. What you're saying is, as long as I think I'm right, I don't have to discuss the legal authority that determines whether I am right.
Well, I think what we're discussing is whether this court can sua sponte find those claims.
Yes, and whether we can do that depends on particular legal authority, and I just told you what they are.
Correct.
And one might think that in a case like this, the counsel for the state would discuss the controlling legal authority.
Perhaps I think we're at a misunderstanding, at least I'm not understanding you, that we're not asking this court to sua sponte find procedural default and time bar. We're merely saying that the state hasn't forfeited those, and whether those claims have merit has nothing to do with whether this court should sua sponte find a forfeited claim available because it wasn't forfeited. But regardless, this court doesn't need to reach procedural default and time bar because the exception under costs is not met. This court should affirm the denial of his request for a petition for habeas corpus.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And counsel, I consumed a lot of your time, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you have something.
The first thing I'd note is that I did not prepare the briefs here, and if this court would like, we could certainly submit a 28J letter or some sort of supplemental briefing on the two questions, Judge Easterbrook, that you put to the state. We'd be happy to do that if that would be the court's desire.
We will let you know if we think it's required.
Okay. The other thing I would note is even in the event that this court were to find that the state did not forfeit its procedural default defense and that the procedural default defense has merit, under Wainwright, Mr. Grigsby could still proceed if this court finds cause and prejudice. And cause and prejudice could be found. Cause would be in the fact that his failure to raise the claim before the Indiana Supreme Court was justified in light of the fact that the Indiana Court of Appeals had not passed on it. And prejudice would be found in the fact that if in fact his Sixth Amendment claim is valid, and all indications in the record are that there was an initial waiver hearing here without the benefit of counsel, that's a clear violation of the Sixth Amendment. If in fact that is the case, that means that his plea of guilty to the armed robbery account was without jurisdiction. That's plain prejudice. And I'd ask this court to consider the Wainwright test in the event it does conclude that the claim was procedurally defaulted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And, counsel, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.